Welcome to the Growth Hacking Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Ivan Palomino. This podcast is about thought-provoking ideas to scale up and growth hack performing and human-centric work cultures. My guests are experts on mindsets, skills, and science behind work cultures. I hope you enjoy this episode.
The bad news about merger and acquisition is that merger and acquisition deals can have a significant negative impact on employees. And this can contribute to the overall failure of the M&A. And you know me already, so I like data. So I've been looking around and I found like study of PricewaterhouseCoopers that found that 50% of employees leave a company within the 24th month of an M&A. Wow, that's a lot. Now, there is another of the big five, Deloitte, who found that 70% of employees experience a decline in morale during the M&A. And another thing that counts a lot in the bottom line of the company is that a study by Willis Towers Watson found that M&A deals can lead to a 20 to 30% decrease in productivity in the short term. So it's not like it's going to take time. And I wanted to discuss about mergers and acquisitions and what we can do about it with Jonathan Bennett, who is my guest today. And the reason is that he has a very serious professional experience in terms of mergers and acquisitions. Some of his customers, because he's an advisor and executive coach for founders, CEOs, C-suite, are maybe telling him in the ear about how much they are enjoying or not enjoying these mergers and acquisitions. So he is the founder of a company called Clearly Then. And before being a founder, before founding this coaching and advisory company, he founded a management consulting firm. And he also held senior executive roles in the healthcare industry. Jonathan, am I right about that? So this is your path: corporate, management consulting, and now giving support for all these C-suite guys who are suffering and sometimes in silence. Is that right?
You've got it. Thank you, Ivan. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's quite a pleasure, in fact, because it's very rare that we discuss about the impact of M&A on the people. And the sad reason is that most of the time we focus on the successes of merger and acquisition are going to bring more productivity, more money for shareholders. And sometimes it brings maybe some impact on the final and the end customers. But these two entities being put together with different cultures, different ways of doing things, create an impact on the employees. And I wanted to ask you, Jonathan, how would you describe when an M&A is going wrong from a human perspective? What have you heard or observed about the impact on employee?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big shock for most employees when they find that their organization is getting merged or acquired with another company. Mostly these discussions and negotiations are happening in private and they're confidential for obvious and proper reasons. And so when an employee group, middle management group, even senior management group learn that their company is being bought or merged or integrated, if they're a big, maybe a nonprofit going through a similar process, it's a shock. Of course, everybody begins with, what does this mean for me? And that's, it takes a good long while for us to move out from the initial self sort of space. And quite literally, employee groups find it very difficult to even hear or process information. And so they certainly don't care about the future of the company or how it might get merged or whatever is to happen next. They're not there yet. That is to come. At the start, it's, am I whole? Am I safe? How about my colleagues next to me? What about my current work today? Like, does this even matter? And so they're very focused on just their own kind of, it's at the bottom of Maslow, you know, like really, really basic things at the start. And it's not until some time passes and they start to understand the ramifications, the ripple effects of the decision and how it's going to affect them or not affect them or benefit them, that they can begin to sort of process it.
Jonathan, you have mentioned a very important word that is often used during the merger and acquisition, this confidentiality. Now, the question is my curiosity. Does everything needs to be confidential, especially during the merger and acquisition? Is there a way to put some parts, maybe the financials, in one side of the secrecy and be a little bit more open as a CEO, as a senior leader with certain aspects of the acquisition and being a little bit more open in terms of what could go wrong? Show that you are part of that battle. What is your take on that?
I mean, it's really context dependent. I think there are some opportunities to be more open in some cases, in some sectors. There are, for example, social purpose companies that are maybe employee owned or have a lot more, like have a flatter structure. And if they're merging or being acquired by another company with a very similar culture, I could see those environments being really open to employee engagement and creating a kind of change process that they could participate in as the merger was going forward. I'd say they'd be the exception as opposed to the rule. Under most circumstances, privately held companies are gonna keep that very, very tightly held and very confidential until the deal is done and they're ready to reveal it. Lots of reasons, competitive reasons, the loss of, if you give employees, especially, hard to find employees, too much runway to get freaked out and worried, they really will leave before the deal is done. And that could jeopardize the deal. So I think there's lots of good reasons for the confidentiality. On a personal and ethical level, I would suggest anytime there's an opportunity to be transparent, to be open, to include people in your journey, then obviously I personally would invite leaders to consider how they could do that. But I also am very sensitive to the fact that it's often too difficult to do that. And so it becomes, unfortunately, you create a kind of moment and it's the big reveal. And then there's shockwaves on both sides. Often, one company is often larger than another. They're maybe adjacent in their, like verticals. The contexts are really, really many and varied. It can move all the way from what an exciting opportunity. My small company is getting, eaten by a much larger one. I've now got career growth and career opportunities, places to learn and grow that I didn't previously have. And that might mean for me as an employee, super exciting. It could also mean that I'm about to be made redundant because they don't need two of me in the new structure. It could mean a real grieving process because I wanted and I actually chose a small company. I wanted something that was smaller and manageable. I came maybe from a much larger company and that's not what I want. And now, the owner that I had, chosen and believed in their vision has now kind of sold out and is now, cashed out and now I'm part of a large company again. So, I've kind of got grief for myself. I've got feelings of anger and disloyalty, maybe for the person whose company I joined and whose vision I believed in, and everything in between. So it's a real grab bag. You can have employees inside, a single company who are feeling all of these things. Some will be excited. Some will be worried and frustrated. Some will think this is the end of the world. Some will think the world is just opening up for them. And really, as leaders, we've got a lot of work to do to bring everybody along and help them process and adjust to what is happening.
And that goes with my next question. In fact, in this grieving process, how can companies manage the process or help employees effectively? How should they hold the hand of the employee so that he doesn't leave or he doesn't feel overstressed? What could be your suggestion or recommendation?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the literature would suggest that there's, you know, a difference between change and transition. You know, we often focus on change management processes, and that's a very kind of management orientated way of thinking about what two companies are doing as they mesh and come together in all of the different ways. But on the people side, people are going through a kind of transition. It's a reimagining of their own identity inside a job. They didn't just change jobs. They changed the place where they work, even if they're literally at the same desk. No doubt the workplace culture will shift and change. Sometimes it's very dramatic, very, very difficult for them. They've maybe enjoyed working in a very flat structure and now it's very hierarchical. Maybe there's a very collaborative leadership style and now it's very top down. And so there's, you know, a period of not just adjustment, but a period of choice making that folks need to go through, which is, am I, you know, I'm stationary, but the world just changed around me. Am I suddenly in the wrong place? Is this right for me? How long do I need to wait before I have, you know, kick the tires here and figured out whether or not this is a place for me? And so all of that is happening. And I think that, you know, as a metaphor, grief is actually quite a good one. I often joke that, you know, in circumstances like this, we're going to ride the Kubler-Ross curve, you know, the old, you know, all the stages of grief. And, you know, I mean, that as a model in palliative care and associated worlds, folks will tell you that's a kind of dated model. But I think as a kind of archetype for us to sort of think about the fact that there really are ages and stages of emotional reaction, responsiveness, and grief that people experience during these times, that everybody will have a range. There'll be some people that will be angry and experience denial, will feel rejected. They'll feel like the company that they work for has been disloyal to them. Some will move quite quickly to acceptance. Some will see opportunity where other people see, you know, only negative things. And so as a leader, managing folks through these rises and falls and shifts in their feelings is really the job. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about this, Ivan, is that for the people that are leading the merger or the integration or the acquisition, you've been locked up in a room, potentially dreaming, planning for this for a very long time. You're about to get cashed out, maybe, or you're about to double your size of your company, or you're about to finally buy your competitor, whatever it is. You've known about this for a very long time. You also went on an emotional journey. It's different, but you went on one. But it was a good long while ago. And then you got into accountants and lawyers and EBITDAs and all kinds of stuff as you figured out the mechanics of the deal. And then you do the big reveal. And you're emotionally stable. You're thinking about the future. You've got plans in place. And you've just entered a room where people, this is brand new information. And all they're saying is me, 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 me. That's all they can think about. And so I see frustrated leaders all the time that wonder why the heck their people are struggling or just don't get it or why they can't get on board faster. And really, it's because you did that emotional labor way back then. You need to give people the grace and space to go through that now. And it will take, you know, imagine how long you think it's going to take and then triple it. It takes a long time for people to do all of the emotional work. you've just literally blown up their work world, and it's going to take them some time if they choose to stay with you. And that's okay. And it's your job to support them and encourage them and give them what they need as they go through the Kubler-Ross curve to come out the other side and reattach, recommit, and find themselves in this new organization, new structure, new company that you've just been a part of creating.
One of the common mistakes that I see in organizations when there is a merger and acquisition is that they use as a plan, a change management plan. And you pointed out quite well, it is about transition. It's not about change because we don't know yet where is everything going in terms of the employees. So having this change management frameworks, ProSci or whatever you are using, applied is the wrong thing. The best thing is to have a plan for the transition. The other thing that I take out of what you mentioned is also that the essential role of the manager in order to reassure the people, in order to empathize with them. In fact, they don't need to know all of the information that you know, but they need to feel that they are listened. And also, you have to allocate as a leader a certain bandwidth, because as you say, that we the leaders have certain emotions, and of course, they also get frustrated to deal with all these hundreds of people who are going to be asking questions that they cannot answer. Frustration for the change and so on. And as you mentioned it quite well, it is something that they went through, but before them. So why don't we have a little bit of empathy and realize the out in the path of self-awareness that we went through this before. So now is the time for them and to support them in a better way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Empathy is key. And I think that we bring on these change management frameworks and just lay them across onto people, and we expect people to perform in ways that are just unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And we bring our whole selves to work to the degree to which what our personality and what our childhood and all of the stuff, the tools that we have as a human to deal with change and transition, like they're the moments that all of that stuff gets triggered. And, it can be confusing for a manager to try to figure out why I've got employee A who's like, grieving, employee B who can't wait to find out whether or not they get a promotion through all this, employee C who's wondering whether they're just going to survive. And all of those things are true, and they're in the same room. So it's I think the job of management is to over-communicate through this process. There's one thing that I see often that I'll flag for you and your listeners. There's often a lot of unknowns through this process, through processes like this. Which of the IT solutions will be the one that we ultimately all use? Which of the policies? What about, so we got to pick and choose. And, the common refrain is kind of like, we'll pick the best of both. And we'll have a best in breed of each, it doesn't typically work that way. There's usually a dominant culture or a dominant leader, and that typically will win out and crush the other side's version of the things. Not always, but if you were going to kind of look at it in a generalized kind of way. And so through that, people don't know the answers to a lot of stuff. And so people's instinct when they don't know the answer is to not communicate because they don't have enough and they don't want to, I don't want to worry people. And so what I usually say to that is, actually you need, that's a great opportunity when you don't have an answer, when you don't have information yet, is to communicate process, is to communicate what you do know. So it could be like, let's just pick an IT system. We've got two existing legacy systems coming together, and your employees that run those systems or that use them every day are like, well, is it going to be ours or the other companies? Which is it going to be? And your answer isn't, I don't know. or we don't know, or I guess we'll find out when they tell us. There's going to be a process that we're going to go through. We're going to evaluate. We're going to audit the current state. We're going to get your input. In about 60 days, I commit, like, here's a meeting that will address this. Mm-hmm. And so everybody's anxiety level can go down to know that, you know, there's no answer. They didn't give me an answer there. But what they did commit to is including me, asking me, and they're going to get back. They've given me a timeline when they're going to give me an update. They still might not have an answer, but they do know when I'm going to get information next. And so that makes me a lot calmer.
And it's crazy that our brain functions on the way that about that we hate uncertainty. And having a deadline at least is something that reassures and relieves a little bit the stress of everybody. So I love this, that in the way to communicate, there needs to be a process. And one of the key milestones is to commit to some outcomes at a certain time, because it adds up to the uncertainty of what is going to happen if we say it depends on someone else. No, that's, yep. We don't listen. It's too much uncertainty. But if we know that we are going to get the answer at a given time, it's much more, it's better in reality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, if we think about employees, we think about a way of doing things in one of the companies, we're thinking also about culture, the culture of the organization. What have you seen as the biggest challenges that company face during this culture? Because it's not like one is going to inherit the other. There is a lot of uncertainty. We don't want to change the way that like if we are a small company, this familiarity that we have between employees. What are the major challenges in terms of culture when you have an M&A? What have you observed on that side?
Yeah, I think what happens too often is when a smaller company is getting purchased by a larger one, there's a loyalty that an owner or a group of owners can have for the folks that they've encouraged to join their vision over the years, and who have enjoyed a kind of workplace culture and a deep trust. And so a promise gets made that sounds something like, we've chosen this company to merge with because they're going to keep us whole. They are really attracted to the culture that we have, and they've promised us that we're going to keep it, and we're going to keep operating in the same way that we always have, and that we're just going to be, you know, taken care of in this little bubble over here, and we're going to keep doing what we're doing. And, you know, that is the big lie. And people believe it. Those owners believe it when they're getting purchased, and even the purchasers believe that they will do that. But obviously what happens over time is that that gets eroded, that new people come and go in the original smaller company, which tends to erode it. They weren't there before. The acquisition, maybe it kept the CEO or president or senior people on for a year, 18 months, 2 years. That time comes and goes, and it just eventually gets absorbed by the mothership. And it starts almost immediately in ways that are small. And what that promise does is it deflates the relationship that people have with those employees. And so they feel like not only did they agree to something that they weren't sure about, that they got a bit lied to. And that is really, really unfortunate. And so I think there's nothing wrong with founders who grow a beautiful company to decide to create an exit. I love it when, especially if there's really strong workplace culture, that people do management buyouts or they do employee-based buyouts, which I'm seeing, you know, more and more of. I think that's fantastic and very sort of, you know, progressive and has a real social purpose to it. But as often as not, founders have put in a lot of sweat and a lot of heartache and a lot of their own emotional labor to get to build a company to the point that it's built, and they want an exit and they want to get paid. And I'm great with that. I think that that's appropriate. And one of the many ways that one exits a company is to sell it. And so, so that's perfectly fine. What I don't love is when promises that you can't keep get made. And so I, you know, always encourage my clients when I'm coaching founders that are, organizing and orchestrating an exit, is to not make promises that they can't keep, because they won't be there to keep them. And, I just say to just keep it honest and real, which is to say, things will change. We do some amazing things, and they'd be smart to look at the awesome things that we do and learn from us. Will they? We'll see. We'll advocate for ourselves. The evidence of our performance is why they're buying this company. Let's hope they learn from that and they want to keep it. But down the road, who knows how things may evolve. So what I do know is the next 6 months is going to look like X, or the next 18 months is going to look like Y. Beyond that, I won't be the person that's making the calls. So I can't make promises that I can't keep.
You have mentioned that during this conversation about the importance of having a process in place to help people to successful transition during the M&A. According to you, what are the key steps of this process? And how can we include the human side in that process? And this third sub-question is, who takes care of that process? Is it the CEO, an HR person?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's everybody's job to take care of it. Everybody that's leading people needs to feel empowered to participate in the culture transition. I mean, what is culture except the sum total of every individual that works in an organization? So, if you've got a team of 10 people, they're your people. You may feel like in middle management that you don't know a lot, but looking after your people and holding space, letting them talk through their worries and fears and hopes and dreams is what you're doing now. And it's what you need to continue to do during the transition. And so I think that's important. I think tone from the top and the CEO, whether it's the old CEO who's exiting or the new CEO who's coming up, needs to play an outsized response. There needs to be a real meaningful process of communicating, of going on a journey, and it's not just like an emotional journey. It's also obviously the actual like workflows and processes of bringing two companies together, and whatever that's going to mean in whatever context it is, that needs to be taken care of in a really thoughtful way. And it's easy, I think, when a larger company buys a smaller one, to just think that our bigger system is going to be better. But actually, there's a lot of agility in small companies. There's a lot of creativity. Sometimes the secret sauce isn't super obvious of why a smaller company was doing so well. And, it moves from whatever, 50 people or 100 people into this something that's got thousands and thousands of people. And its elegance is somehow just immediately, it just vanishes. And nobody really can ever figure out what it really was. But it was often just speed, and it was often creativity. And it often can come down to, a half dozen key people in an organization that were really making it hum in the way that it was. And if they leave or they get moved into new roles, suddenly the magic's gone. And it's easy to break things without realizing what it is that you're even breaking when you buy something.
But do you see this as a process? Is there a step one, a step two, or is it an iteration that needs to be done rather than a linear process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yes, sort of change management process, there's definitely some phases, we'll call it, as opposed to steps. I think an early careful phase, which sounds a lot like let's just keep things as they are in steady state and try to learn about one another, and then go through a kind of second phase, which is let's evaluate our processes and systems, how and where do we mesh well together, how might we learn from one another. That, you know, looks like a discovery phase. The next phase after that is let's convert those into projects, transformation projects. Let's choose IT system A or B. Let's go through a reorganization of our people. Let's move through workflows, or let's consolidate and eliminate waste. All of those are, you know, in that next phase. Along the bottom, though, is the people part of all of this, and the emotional journey that people go through. And I think it's easy to forget about that, especially if folks don't understand that the legacy company or whoever's system or process is being moved on or let go of or sunsetted, you know, they might have spent a huge chunk of their career building that thing. They might have been on the original RFP team that procured it. They may have deep relationships with suppliers. So it can feel really personal in unexpected ways as you move through these phases.
Jonathan, I want to dig a little bit more into this, what I call the gossip inside. So do you have any internal stories of companies that have been really good at managing this emotional journey of an M&A? And do you have also the horror stories from companies that have been completely wrong at managing this emotional journey?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to tell you a personal story about how things went well. You know, I grew a management consulting company. And when I got to the point of deciding to sell, I thought quite a bit about what my exit should and could be. But I had an employee that was coming through that I really felt could lead the company. And so instead of selling externally, I sold internally. And so we orchestrated a management buyout. And, you know, that was really reassuring for all of the staff, for all of our customers, that they already knew her. They already knew how it was running. And so we took a nice long runway. We moved her into the CEO role. I stepped back and I just went and did consulting work again. Like I went back 10 years in my career and I just, you know, like went back at it. I was leading projects again, which was like both interesting and also quite humbling, because on the humbling side, suddenly this company that I still owned on paper, but that I'd handed to a new CEO who was now running it, everybody's loyalty shifted to her. And I was still there, right? and so it felt like, you know, it felt like, well, hey, I'm still like, what am I, chopped liver? Like, I'm still here, guys. Like last week, you thought I was all that in a bag of chips. And now you've moved on. And so people know where their bread is buttered, of course. And but what that really did do is it taught me a great life lesson, which is that when you are moving on from a role, you really do have a best before date, and you need to get off the stage while the crowd is still clapping, and get out of there while there's still like the opportunity for healthy transition to occur. And I'm really proud of what Danielle and I were able to accomplish through that transition. You know, it was a smaller company, but we definitely were able to transition it smoothly and not lose anybody and not lose any customers. And it was just steady as she goes. And so that I think was a really beautiful thing. And I'm proud of my small role in how all that went down. If I think about my clients, there are lots of horror stories. There are lots of really difficult stories. For example, in the public sector, often, you know, a single government funder will mandate large publicly funded organizations to merge. Cost efficiencies, reimagining of structures of things, you know, new political regimes. There's lots and lots of different reasons. They can be really complex environments, multiple trade unions, jurisdictions, people fighting for turf, essentially quasi-political environments. And I've seen some of them be some of the most toxic workplaces ever. Healthcare, social services, education, they're all sectors in you know, any Western kind of economy that have a lot of government investment, often, not always, but often have a lot of government investment. And so when those mergers happen, they're really very, very difficult, complex environments. And I've seen them, some of them go spectacularly bad. And you know, to the extent to people like refusing to use the new logo, people refusing to adopt to a new practice, and or just doing it the old way via stealth, and largely it's because there's workforces that aren't easily moved on. You know, they have a lot of tenure, they may be protected through a collective agreements, all those kinds of things. So some of those are some of the most difficult. And then on the private sector side, you know, we've sort of touched on some of the things that can really go wrong. But I think the biggest things to look out for in terms of red flags are false promises and just getting too ambitious about your own goals and wishes and desires as a leader, and remembering that your employees don't have the same stake in all of this as you do, and they have choices that they can make, and one of them is they can just leave, and you really can't. You have much less maneuverability through a process like this, and so take as much care and use, as you said, you know, as much empathy through the process as you can.
You know, you make me think that I have observed that during the merger and acquisition, very often in the due diligence step or phase. We exchange numbers, financials, value of assets, and a little bit about the organization. But very rarely, the culture of the organization is discussed. So that means that the merger could be the merger between a very toxic environment that looks on paper very with a lot of performance, and then you inherit a bunch of idiots with a bad toxic culture. And that happens because they are not discussing, they're just discussing numbers instead of also discussing people or the way people are doing things. And that's kind of sad that this is not part of the diligence.
You know, it's so true. And, you know, I'm trying to think about, I've seen elements of investigations of culture informing and feeding, you know, large investments by private equity into companies or capital investment into companies, where it's not just like when it's their money that's at stake, but they're not doing an M&A, they will go in and learn a lot about culture. So I think there's some lessons there because, you know, they know their money is only safe if the people are going to take care of themselves and take care of the money. And, and so, you know, they go that deep. But you're right. You know, it's funny when two companies that are privately held look at merging, it is very transactional. It's very legal. It's very accounting based. I'm not saying the leaders don't sit down and talk about workplaces and workplace culture and stuff, but it's pretty surface level, to your point. You know, I don't see other than, you know, sort of the tour and the walkabout, you know, when things are getting close and they're doing a walkthrough. I mean, what's that going to tell you? Nothing, right? Like it's very surface level. I think that's an excellent point you make.
Tell me, if let's say a CEO, a leader is contemplating the idea of doing an M&A, how can he get prepared in order to manage the emotional well-being of his employees? What are the actions that he could take already before the M&A in order to plan ahead what is going to happen with the people, with these people?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think for any CEO that's getting close to doing some kind of transition for their company, to just take on the truth of how big this will be for everyone else, that you'll be a long way ahead of them. So you'll go through the emotional journey. If it's your company, if it's privately held and you've grown it and you're the majority shareholder, like, it's your identity. It's your life. So you're going to go through a huge, huge emotional burden. Like, I've worked with people that, you know, founded a company 28 years ago and they're selling it now. Or they're, you know, they founded a company 10 years ago and they built the thing and it needs to not have the guerrilla startup entrepreneur, but it needs the professional management to now take it to the next level. And so they're selling. And the emotional burden of that journey for them is huge. But if they're staying on, or even if they're transitioning, you know, it's, they get amnesia about that they went through it. And then what's wrong with everybody else? And so, you know, my counsel is always just slow the heck down. Give them how much, like, you know, so like I can say, when did you first start thinking about this? And they'll say, oh, well, I don't know, it was before the pandemic. And you're like, okay, so you thought about it for whatever, 3 or 4 years, and then you kind of had a couple of, dipped your toe in a couple of spots and learned some things. And then you found, you know, two potential things and you explored it with one, but you went to the second one and blah, blah, blah. All of that, there's an emotional journey. And it's a series of imaginative exercises that you go through about like letting go, moving on to the next phase of your life. How do I, you know, think about myself in this next phase of my career, or am I moving into retirement or whatever else? Like, all of that is just pure emotion. You've talked to friends, you talk to your coach, you talk to maybe your spouse, you've gone through all of that. Well, guess what? That was 3 years. Now you've gone, hey, everybody, let's meet in the lunchroom. I've got some big news, right? You know, or let's all jump onto, you know, Zoom and, you know, squares on a board. And suddenly you're saying, I've got some wonderful news. We're being acquired by this fabulous company and they're going to be amazing and they're not going to change anything and blah, blah, blah. And then 2 weeks later, you're like, why aren't you guys like loving this? Like, this is amazing. Well, they're where you were before the pandemic. They need all this time to go through their own version of that because it's their whole world. They had career aspirations as well. They have, you know, professional development goals and personal development goals that they were planning on, and you've just thrown a wrench in all of that. So they need time to process it. So, you know, my advice to my clients is always just sit with them, just be with it, just give it the time it's going to take, and don't overpromise, and just be as realistic and as transparent as you can be under the circumstances, and you'll help them through it.
We are reaching close to the end of this episode with Jonathan Bennett on the human cost of M&A. And we have talked about anxiety, culture clash, and transition management, which is quite amazing, Jonathan, to be sincere, to understand, because when you put the things into perspective, you are talking to me like you are a businessman. You are not talking to me like an HR person or somebody who is a coach. You are sharing with me and also with the rest of the audience this experience that you have got through the different clients that you have got in your own company, and also your own experience by when you sold your management consulting company, which is quite insightful. Thank you, Jonathan. Tell me, if people want to reach you out, what is the best way to contact you, to ask you questions?
Yeah, thank you. I love it when people reach out. I get lots of direct messages on LinkedIn. I post fairly often on LinkedIn, so feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and book a call with me. I usually spend an hour with folks and just a free call and letting people you know, have some coaching, and at the end of which you'll know if I'm the right kind of coach for you. And so just reach out if you want to read more about my work or a lot of you know, podcasts and other content, clearlythen.com is my company's website.
Jonathan, I will be putting the links for your LinkedIn profile and CleanlyDen website below this episode. I want to really thank you sincerely for the time that you have allocated to me and to my audience at the Growth Hacking Culture podcast. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure, Ivan.